Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Transmission Podcast. It's me, Quentin, and this week we've got Paul Reed, founder and chief executive at R Sunrise Energy. Paul is, well, he's got 15 years experience in the energy sector in the US, but he's now very, very focused on the Northeast and is a developer of battery assets in the Northeast. So in this conversation, we spend quite a bit of time focused on New York, PJM, and Northeastern RTOs, and the incentive structures that are there for battery developers, and what that means for the business case. So really enjoyed this discussion with Paul. As ever, please do let us know what you think in the comments, and don't forget to hit like, subscribe, and all the good buttons. They really do make a difference. Right, let's jump in. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
A very proud Philadelphian is what I'm getting already from you.
A touch, you know, born and raised, and there's local pride to be had up here. You know, when it's in the cold weather and whatnot, and there's a lot of growth to be had, it's good to, have that pride.
And we're going to talk a lot about battery storage, of course, in this episode, but let's start with Philadelphia. What's happening with batteries in Philadelphia, other than you and your firm?
You know, there was a lot of growth here and, in this region, call it 10 years ago. I think a lot of trailblazing happened, the sector projects, things like that. There was, some batteries were operating in 2011, 2012, first batteries in PJM. I've been a part of companies that had a part in that. And then, now seeing California and Texas grow so much while the Northeast has lagged behind, there's, just that Northeast mentality of watching others see a lot grow. But I'm looking forward to trying to help bring that all back around here.
It's going to be boomtown again. And we've got to talk about, you kind of alluded to it there, your time at Ormat, which was, you spent many years at Ormat and they had a big, big impact. So do you just want to talk about that for a second? What did he do at Ormat and what did the firm do and what were some highlights?
Sure, yeah. So when I joined, it was 2012 and it was Viridity Energy. So Audrey Zibelman had, she was COO at PJM and she left and formed this company in 2009-10-ish. I joined in 12. It was growing close to 100 people at the time. And early days in demand response, first battery in PJM, Reg D was a project we had. And kept the company going, demand response, software, behind the meter storage, and then eventually acquired by Ormat in 17 and stayed on through about 27, 9 years overall. So it was a cool story. I mean, I was the ground floor sort of account manager guy starting out. And then by the end, the last couple of years, I ran most of the legacy business, all the demand response, the software, and BTM storage was under me.
And now R Sunrise Energy, which is your company, you founded and are chief executive of, give us the lay of the land. What are you guys doing? And we're going to focus a lot on development here. So keen to understand some trends you're seeing through the developer's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess the quick gap kind of post format was Doral for about 2.5 years. So switched from kind of behind the meter, smaller stuff to the super large grid scale, but purely greenfield side of the world. Doral's pipeline now is close to 15 gigawatts or so. And about 1.5 years ago, kind of started my own venture. So consulting to keep the lights on, I guess kind of, pun intended. And then raising capital and looking for projects. So both greenfield dev. But then, there's a lot of great folks in this area that have started to develop projects that are early, mid, late-ish stage is tough post queue reform. But the trend is there's a lot of gigawatts up here.
Sorry. Just to jump in, and I've got a habit of doing this.
Yeah.
What's queue reform?
So FERC 2023, essentially, to me, is a good thing. It's clearing the queues out. For over a decade, it wasn't hard to file a queue position. I mean, it even used to be where you could file without land control. Because the tools...
This is grid connection queue we're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, so the MISO queues. There was a lack of tools and knowledge on how to really understand what can I connect at a certain sub or line. So folks would kind of just leverage the ISOs to do that for them because it was cheap and refundable and, there was very little risk. So the queues have been overloaded to the point that PJM and New York kind of paused their queues for a couple of years. But so now post-queue reform, the queues will be clearing out. Leads to certain assets becoming available to potentially acquire. But at the very least, it forms a more functional system similar to what has been there in Texas, for example.
So the world's changed since queue reform, which was nationwide pretty much apart from Texas because it's outside of FERC. Mm-hmm. And that means that for developers, well, tell me, how does that change things for developers?
Well, there was a pause, so it kind of put a stop on all, you know, all dev, at least new dev in the area for a couple of years. So folks all gravitated elsewhere, right? So lots of, you know, ERCOT, WEC, SPP, some MISO, but you combine that and then those pauses lead to higher capacity prices clearing in PJM, for example, that triggers a bit of a signal to come back is the mindset. So supportive state policies, stable markets long term. Yeah, that's that's what folks are looking for. So I guess very tactically with Q reform, right? So deposits, letters of credit, a lot will not be as refundable as it was. So we'll lead to a lot of projects becoming distressed from a capital perspective. They'll have to sell, they'll have to, you know, let options go. So there's going to be a bit of a market for transactions in the next, call it 18 months, PJM especially. And then, should lead to a hopefully quicker, more efficient, you know, actually functioning queue process for the next 3, 4, 5 years.
And so if I hear you right, before the change, you could submit, the incentives weren't there to prevent loads and loads of grid applications because the amount of credit that you needed or the amount of work you need to have done or the capital requirements or whatever weren't, they created a world where everybody was sticking in tons and tons of grid applications. And then the change has come in where it's become a lot more rational and you really have to vote with your capital and be a bit smarter about where you're applying for grid connections. And there's more capital at risk. And that means that a lot of these sites or projects are going to have to come to market. They're either going to have to raise money or they're going to have to come to market. And that's quite interesting. So then what happens?
Well, you get a bit of a churn and, you know, turmoil. Yeah, but again, the goal is to take this hit rate of about 10% of projects actually reach NTP from queue filing. It's also led to quite a growth in the software business. Fantastic tools are out there, you know, tools like Anira, for example, and some newer players like Peak, for example. But now companies either can go out and buy these tools or build them themselves and not have to leverage the phase one feasibility studies to know what can I connect, how much should I, apply with for the queue. So thankfully, those tools are now coming out. And it's just the market and smart folks coming to meet the need of an issue of knowing how much can I build here.
Because you can't do the scattergun approach anymore. You have to be much more tactical.
Mm-hmm. Caps has to be deployed very carefully.
Can we just talk about state and federal policies for a second? So the IRA or other incentives. You sort of alluded to this earlier in what you're saying. Can you give our audience the lay of the land? This is quite a broad question, so excuse me. But the lay of the land with incentives. Maybe we start with the IRA and then the incentives that you think are really attractive that you, not to give too much of your intellectual property away, but where are the areas of these incentives that you think are really moving the needle and affect what you're doing?
Yeah, and it's a neat way to kind of parse it out, you know, policy driven versus cost driven dynamics. I think with the IRA tax equity, it's made it big business, first of all. So all things election, all that stuff aside, it's protected now in ways. It's helped to make it towards this, you know, sort of a no-brainer approach and approval. You know, when you get into complexities of debt and equity and all that, at least you have this kind of federally backed mandate that you can run with. And then once you're within a market, you know, there's going to be, it'll be mostly pretty homogenous on value, but that's where certain state policies then come into play that'll help attract, you know, more growth and more development in those states. And that just makes it easier, whether it's sort of upfront incentives, like in New Jersey and Illinois, or New York with the ongoing sort of a revenue certainty, you know, product that they're coming out with. But either way, it's about upfront incentives and then ongoing revenue certainty, but that'll just attract business to your state.
So can we talk about a couple of those in more detail? Let's start with New York, because that gets a lot of press for good reason. So what are they designing in New York?
Yeah, so the index storage credit seems like a very, a New York way to do it, sort of a bidding process. And then
Philadelphia's shining through now.
It's fine, you know, when you can speak the language too. And, you know, It's a kind of thing where if your sports team is, you know, going against like somebody from the West or the South, like then you're cool with them. But day to day, you're not for them. But no, it's a neat concept, and they're tying it to kind of market factors and market signals that folks in the know can kind of get a feel for. So the top bottom 4 hour way to normalize kind of what you should have made per year. It does seem to be there's going to be a bit of a bidding process, and you kind of set up like a make whole number that you would want and need. But at the very least, there's a way to provide a mechanism for folks to at least have that comfort and certainty. It's a risk thing. So as long as there's more policy that supports kind of risk management, that'll just lead to more capital deployment.
So how does it actually work in New York then? If you in your job, you're finding and developing sites, and you have to think about, let's say, a 20-year lifespan of an asset, and you build a business case in Excel. The most perilous thing to do in any working life is putting this stuff in Excel. And so how does what New York is planning to do impact your business case? And how does it work in practice? How does it make sure that the dollars appear in your business case?
Yeah, and I guess what's nice now is kind of looking at so many different states. I mean, Northeast is, you know, 20 states when you look at the three ISOs up here. You know, it's about a revenue certainty, but for the purpose of debt coverage, really. So really what I see this mechanism is a way to provide that, you know, of the percentage of project that is debt, what is my annual payment I know I need to make no matter what. And then it's about finding the right folks that are happy with that sort of upside potential. So what I see this mechanism is just a way to cover some, you know, downside case. Similar as, you know, hedging and bilaterals and PJM on capacity, you know, taking parts of the value stack, lose that upside, but guarantee it. You're covered on debt. And then as long as you have the right folks comfortable with the, you know, merchant aspects or other types of offtake, then you're pretty well covered and you can deploy and take care of all the other odds and ends.
And when's it coming and how much are they going to buy and at what price?
So New York, right, they set a target of 3 gigs, right, by, what was it, 2020, something like that. And then they knew they weren't going to hit that, so they doubled down and just said, let's make it 60, you know, gigs now by, what, 2030. But there was a lot of learning that, yeah, there was a lot of tech risk throughout the industry that, thanks to the growth in California and Texas, has helped make it bankable, right? It's about the boring stuff now. Insurance, warranties, guarantees, and finance. No offense to anybody that works in that field, but it's much less about the tech now. And as long as that certainty is there and the lawyers are happy and the CFOs are happy, you know, projects will deploy. And so it's a nice way to go about that.
When, just as an aside, I had this big realization. I think I've talked about it on this podcast before. My old boss, when I worked at a company called Kiwi Power in the UK, I remember him sitting, I was an engineer, and I remember him sitting me down saying, Quentin, it's all very well banging on about the engineering, but it's the finance that really makes a difference. I had this big realization in my late 20s. I've always thought it's the technology that matters. And actually, I think he said it was the cost of capital that matters. And I think he was in many ways right, but I'm going to fight it a bit more.
Which type were you, sorry, as far as engineer? What type of engineer were you?
So I was an electrical engineer, well, electrical and electronics engineer. Oh. And I did a bit of engineering, mm-hmm. did a few years, a big PLC in the UK. But I found, so I loved learning, I love physics. And here we go, it's a podcast about me now. But I love the engineering and the maths and the science. And I love building things. I love those skills. I just found working to standards very difficult. So I found that the engineering job became someone else defines the standards. Yeah. And it's my job to fit within, you know, you can be creative within these very fine, defined guardrails. And my brain struggled to do that day in, day out. So I decided engineering wasn't for me long term. And now I do this, whatever this thing is, my daughter says, what do you do for work, daddy? I don't really know. I
come and thought leadership.
Anyway, that's beside the point.
And sorry, I was a chemi and had a minor in physics, and I'm with you on those guardrails. Like, and now I love that we have that for this industry, though, to pull back. I mean, you know, all the UL, all the National Fire Code, you know, the last 5 years have been fantastic with what's happened in other states. So I think now it's more bankable to now come back to the Northeast is part of my investment thesis.
Yes, although it could be quite different if we've got to build a manufacturing base, which we are in the US. I'm not going to say from scratch, but it's not far away, is it? So we shall see how that plays out. But let's come back to New York, right? So New York's going to do 6 gigs of grid-scale batteries by 2030. It's sort of moved the goalposts, but that's okay. What about the other incentives that you talked about there? So you mentioned Illinois, you mentioned PJM. What's happening elsewhere in the Northeast?
Yeah, and just real quick on New York, I do think they've taken that 6 gigawatts and they parse it out into 2-2-2. So 2 plus grid, 2 plus DG-ish, and then 2-ish resi stuff or small CNI. So they are going to try to split that up, which just leads to Jersey, for example, you know, 2 different incentives. So, you know, some level, I heard like $20 and $40 per on a kilowatt hour, which doesn't sound like a ton. But at least they're going to kind of bifurcate the grid scale versus DG scale. But just a really basic sort of upfront incentive, nice and simple. Same as Illinois. The Jersey numbers I do need to go back to and double check. I think it might be bigger than that, actually, quite a bit. But we do know as far as Illinois, it's $250 per kilowatt hour upfront. And then even paired with PV, what? $250 per kilowatt on the PV side.
$250 what?
Dollars.
$250. Mm-hmm. Okay, you get that up front.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty high, actually.
Yeah.
Let's say it costs you, say, $500 a kilowatt to build. It depends on sure. Chinese tariffs and whatnot and all sorts of stuff. Let's say ballpark $500.
Sure.
That's pretty good.
They're trying to make it a no-brainer policy. Take away all the risk for everybody, so you have to do it. Because, again, folks are still, they struggle to get comfortable with it. Takes time.
So let's talk about the Inflation Reduction Act then. How does the IRA fit in? And as somebody who is largely exposed to the IRA, I'm sure you've been grappling with it over the last couple of years as, you know, there was the big announcement and then there was, okay, guys, now how do we actually implement this thing? And what do the gray areas look like? But could you just talk through how the IRA incentives work in brief? And then some of the refinements that have been made along the way that may have had a fairly big impact on you and what you do as a developer.
Sure. The biggest thing started out was to have a guaranteed standalone storage tax credit, right? In the past, it had to be paired with PV, charge from PV. I guess we're okay.
Charging the battery from PV.
Correct.
It's just a key distinction for our listeners that not to jump in. Mm-hmm. It's funny. We've got people in the YouTube comments who say, always jump in. Maybe I do.
No, please. It's better.
But yeah, so could you just explain the charging from PV thing?
Yeah, there was a sort of a set of cliffs, if you will, that if you 100% charge from PV, then you get the full 30% ITC. And then, for every percentage of charging that was not PV, you would lose a percent of the ITC, but not like, so 30 to 29. Da, da, da. So after, if you were charging less than 70% from PV, you would lose your full, storage ITC. So the IRA addressed that by making, standalone storage, fully able to earn 30, 40, 50% ITC, depending on...
Of the CapEx.
Correct.
So you get 30, 40, 50% back from the tax man mm-hmm. for building the site.
Correct. And provided this, kind of tax equity, tax credit transfer market, sort of opened things up quite a bit more. In the past, you were going to, a couple houses, big financial houses to be able to transact. And now the tax credit transferability is much better than it used to be.
Because there's a range of institutions out there that were more than happy to take that on as a mm-hmm. bit like a bond, like a fixed price contract. And then what about some of the gray areas from the IRA? The IRA has been fairly politically divisive, and we probably won't get into the political side of it. But what about how developers and investors have been coming to terms with the specifics of how the IRA will work in practice? Because it's taken a while for there to be clarity, and the lawyers, I'm sure, have enjoyed themselves all over it.
Lawyers and insurance guys, and I have some fantastic insurance folks, and now sort of a market sprung up to do the tax equity insurance, tax credit insurance, you name it. I think a lot of that is being figured out in sort of normal, kind of normal course of business. I guess the bigger questions are around what does domestic content really mean? systems, subset of systems, what percentage needs to be domestically built and made.
Which is a requirement in some cases, right? That the thing you build is made domestically.
Correct.
Sorry, just to come.
No, of course. No, yeah. So for that 10%, domestic content bonus, some percentage, which is still kind of being figured out, has to be made in the U.S. I have a hunch there's a certain individual with a company that makes batteries who has a hand in federal stuff might be able to trailblaze on that, which is, rising tide raises all ships. And if they take it on the chin to figure it out and then other companies can start manufacturing. Yeah, I do have this kind of Northeast PJM dream of turning the Rust Belt into the battery belt. I think would be a pretty cool thing to see. So once that policy gets...
Tagline.
And it's a dad mode. The taglines come in,
Let's go back to your firm, R Sunrise Energy. So what exactly are you guys doing? What are you focused on?
So I really started it just to have my own LLC cover, consulting. There's a lot of great folks in the DG space. A lot of folks that are doing solar for 10, 15 years that are kind of curious about storage. So it's allowed me to work with a lot of other great folks, local, regional players, teams of 10 and 20 and 30 and 40, looking at storage. So a lot of great consulting, a lot of growth on, again, that scale. But then the other side of it is, this kind of grid scale dream that I have for the Northeast, have a name for the SPV, and it'll be the new face of it. So our Sunrise will kind of go to the background, and then this other name, which hope to announce by the end of the month. We'll do a nice launch for that, working on final capital and all that. So the real dream is a gig and a half, 2 gigs of storage in the Northeast in the next few years. Mixture of projects we'd acquire. A lot of stuff is mid-ish stage. So acquire, call about 500 megawatts or so. Then greenfield about a gigawatt plus. What's been nice starting this and connecting with all the local folks that, you don't see on LinkedIn, you don't see in reports. But people are sitting on land and potential queue positions. I mean, barely shook a tree and it's 5+ gigawatts of good looking standalone projects, 100 megawatts and up, here in the Northeast, a lot of PJM. And so my goal is to look, I know the next 3 to 5 years is a good time to, nose to the grindstone and rather do it for myself.
So your background in energy management software is really interesting, because I want to ask you, knowing all that you know and having done it from a demand side response perspective and a battery optimization perspective, what do you think about the role of optimizers or off-takers or power purchasers in the world of batteries for the Northeast?
So, having spent close to 9 years, though I didn't necessarily work in the NOC, I was kind of in there every day. I'm a network operations center. Just gained a lot of physical comfort with seeing batteries operating, day in, day out. So there's a couple points there. I mean, one is I love all the smart optimizers, EMS. It's great. It fills a need, especially in these multi-state ISOs. A lot of the controls, a lot of the smarts need to sit within the four walls of the market operator. So the customized energies of the world, right? They see a lot of things that, sure, you can, set a weekly schedule, forecast, you name it. But my goal for as I go to operate projects will be to have as few hands in the handshake as possible. And then while I have a lot of, comfort with, merchant operations, revenue certainty, and again, whether it's policy-based or you're going out, tolling agreements, you name it, some of the great things that have happened in Texas, we can bring to the Northeast as well. So there'll be a few different ways to kind of, guarantee parts of the value stack, if not all of it. But the key is strong, tight operations where, again, there's a lot of the smarts is in the same four walls and not spread across three different companies with three different contracts. That's the recipe for, not to say disaster, but a lack of upside.
So in my job, I'm very lucky in that I get to see what happens in Europe and in Australia and in the US. And it's a real privilege. And it's good and bad. It means that I'm no longer really an expert in a specific market, like I used to be when I was just in the UK. But on the other hand, I get to see some big picture stuff. And what strikes me is the difference in appetite between the US and UK and Europe in vertical integration. So not only building, the skill set that's required for developing assets. Lots of companies will take that through to asset ownership as well. And then the skill set that is needed for asset ownership and operations and maintenance and asset management is quite a different skill set to trading in the market or building software and technology. But again, in the US, a lot of firms choose to do that themselves and vertically integrate. Whereas we notice in other markets, that's not so much the case. And people are more willing, or even if they find it more attractive, to hand off that bit of the process and just be good at their little bit. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, you can actually arguably make the same, if not better, returns by doing that, by being highly specialized. But it is interesting to follow, but it's early days and it's an early market, and we don't know how all this is going to shake out. And there's some fantastic market access providers and optimizers out there. So we shall see. But in the Northeast, is it demand side response companies that are edging into battery optimization, or are there specialist optimization houses or off-takers that are popping up, or what does the market for that look like?
Yeah, and it's a bit of kind of listening to the market. I do think there's going to be a lot of growth in the DG space, that kind of 5 megawatt storage, solar storage community, you know, whatever. So some of those smaller scale, you know, demand side focus folks, if they have a knock, they've run, they operate, they're trying to do storage, right? But they're kind of relying on people putting it in and then coming to them. I do think there will be a nice market for some of those players on the DG side of the world, because then the folks that are incumbent on doing 100 megawatt plus projects, you know, they'll be there to cover the need on the grid scale world, you know, the Tenascas and Customized other worlds. But yeah, I think there's going to be a nice market for, you know, C-Powers and whatnot, CISO as well, to do that kind of small to medium scale, that there's going to be a lot of growth. And policy is pushing that because folks can wrap their heads around that.
So being a developer, you have this really interesting job, which is that you have to develop the site, but you also have to sort of specify the site, even though you may not be the one that builds it or goes on to own and operate it in the future. And so you're at development stage, you're making decisions about the asset you're going to build really early on, because you have to, with land sizes and grid connections and technical capabilities and, you know, all of the other regulations that you need to comply with. So when you're developing sites, what are the critical technical challenges that you're considering in a development phase beyond the basic stuff? You know, sure. How many megawatts and how much land do I need? What are the other things that are starting to pop up, especially as the market is maturing and we're having more and more regulation come in, rightly so, to make sure these assets are viable and safe?
So first of all, from a mindset approach, just having that comfort of doing that experience, to actually own and operate, that's how I am approaching it. Even these, you know, sort of greenfield or early stage developments, sure, I may end up flipping projects, but I approach everything from the mindset that I would own and operate. I do think when, you know, you're in the thick of it, and if there's a choice to make where it's 100 grand or 150 grand, if you're going to plan to own and operate yourself, you'll spend the more money and, you know, end up with just a better project overall. The key on the targeting, the, you know, specifics, it's the good upfront software tools. So tools for the revenue modeling, tools for line and sub capacity, then great land permitting, zoning tools. And then as much as folks love to hire and build their teams out, that's where companies are ending up a little bit distressed. So to the extent you can leverage fantastic local resources, consulting firms, environment, you know, all that, it's all there. And instead of me hiring one or two people, I can hire three companies that each have 20, 30, 40, how many other, you know, number of folks. So I'm covered on all those fronts and can spin them up, spin them down as necessary. And so that's why with all this focus on, you know, the revenue side, revenue certainty, to me, that's kind of 1/5 of the overall solution, right? You still got to do the basics that I think, you know, can be lost in the, you know, it's some of the boring stuff, right? But environmental, zoning, permitting, good local relationships, you know the folks, know the area, know the people. And I think that's a lot of where, if you're planning to own and operate yourself, or at least you're locally based and you're planning to dev and flip, you know, it's a very important thing. I especially learned that during my time at Doral. I mean, you got to be local. You got to be there. You got to get in there. You can't big time people. You have to be able to go from the boardroom to the farmhouse, farm kitchen, whatever.
Suit and tie with some Wellington boots on.
Yeah, gotta be versatile, chameleon.
So the narrative in the last couple of years has been that Northeast is too complicated. The queues are too long. Everything is just stuck. You know, why focus on the Northeast when you can deploy your capital in California and ERCOT easier, quote unquote? So tell me I'm wrong.
For me, in one, because I'm here, two, because I've seen it, all that, you know, volatility has made Texas very attractive. 2 years ago was, you know, amazing. And this past year was a bit less. You know, volatility does go the other way. If you want long-term stable markets, here's PJM, you know, 13 states, relatively stable pricing, except now going ahead, prices are going to spike, you know, June 1, 25, you know, one third of your cost stack is, you know, going several multiples up. High costs are high opportunities, right? For power plant developers.
What does that mean? So on the June 1st, something's going to happen.
Yeah. So the new PJM, delivery year starts, and their capacity auctions were also paused for a couple of years. You combine a lot of, you know, expected load growth, data centers, you name it, combined with ongoing retirements. Yeah, it really is a 10-year trend. I mean, we saw some of these spikes in the 2015 timeframe in the ATSI zone, for example. So as people are shocked by seeing some of these items, I'm close to 15 years and I've seen a lot of this stuff happen in various ways. So keep calm, develop on. But again, the key point is the price of capacity in PJM is going to spike RTO-wide. And those are market conditions that are going to remain. So that's a build signal, not only on the grid scale side, but then cost avoidance for demand side folks is going to be a very prevalent item. It's going to be interesting starting June 1.
So we should probably put a link to the show notes about that because it's worth our listeners taking a look at. But yeah, there will be knock-on effects and it will get a lot of attention in the press when these dollars start to appear on bills.
Yeah, my PSA to anybody with a retail supply contract where they have on their bills broken out cap and NIT charges, please go look at those and just be forewarned that while your number of kilowatts or megawatts during the five, you know, PJM peaks may not have changed much, that dollar amount is, you know, possible to spike quite a bit, you know, multiples higher.
Looking forward then, so if you could come up with a shopping list of new incentives or market changes or even tax breaks, why not, for the Northeast to get more batteries built on top of what's already happening, what would be on your shopping list?
So while I'm a bit altruistic, I believe rising tide raises all ships. I mean, you know, I'm a believer. There's a part of me that doesn't mind some barriers to entry. Gives me more time to secure my capital and go capture as many projects as I feel comfortable doing so. I mean, to me, a lot of it is there. The biggest item was Q reform and then the ISO compliance with Q reform, yeah, which still we're still waiting on ISO New England to comply. But I'm happy PJM and ISO have, you know, put in their compliance filings and, you know, relaunched their queues. Number one, just
why are we still waiting? Just to jump in there. Yeah. Why are we still waiting on New England?
I'm not sure. I think they've had less issues. So they never really had to pause their queue. But at some point, they're going to need to do something to at least comply. But it might not mean a full pause and reset, you know, like we saw in PJM, for example. But my, you know, one wish list is just, hey, guys, stick to it. You know, we gave you time to pause, refix everything. You know, let's not wind up back where we were is kind of number one. And then two, you know, supportive state policies. You know, yes, I don't want to see systems and projects of any type going in a place where it shouldn't at the township level. But there does need to be a healthy balance of states coming in to, you know, help override certain townships that may act a little wonky for whatever reasons. But it's also on developers, right? You got to be good, got to be local, you know, talk to people, hire good local folks, which is good for local business, frankly, as well. So really, you know, that's the Q side, the policy local, you know, hearts and minds side. And those are the two most critical things to me that I think get overlooked, at least the local policy side of things. And then otherwise, yeah, it's going to be, you know, banks and lenders and investors that are, you know, they've seen a lot of great stuff in Texas and then, you know,
kind of get excited to see what's going to happen up here. You know, we're, you know, talking three times the size of California and Texas combined within these, you know, 20 states, right? You know, 1/3 of the U.S. is up here, and we're lagging behind heavily in deployments. So guys, come on up. We're here.
It needs to be said more, doesn't it? It needs to be said more. I mean, we've just scratched the surface, really, with Texas and California. Even, you know, Texas and California themselves have got a lot more growth to come. And then there are whole regions that have just not even started yet. Mm-hmm. So reading between the lines, it feels like you're excited about an opportunity over the next couple of years, which I think you're saying you think there's going to be some capitulation with developers, and that might move some good projects onto the market. Am I reading you correctly?
Yes. And look, there's a reason there's as many gigawatts are in the queue as there are. I mean, a lot of folks are doing a lot of dev up here. Things just got kind of jammed up. It's because there will be a natural push up this way. And again, there's going to be churn. There's going to be turmoil. But it's going to ultimately lead to the right projects getting through and operating in the correct ways and, you know, keeping the grid happy and healthy.
And is there anything in the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years that you're really excited about that will change grid scale storage? Maybe it's on the supply chain, or it's technology or regulation or capital. Is there anything that you'd like to point to that really gets you going?
So besides just seeing kind of what I do in the news day to day, you know, my parents live in Las Vegas, and they send me articles out like, oh, there's a 200 megawatt project with MNV Energy coming about. And then I go to folks, you know, in my area, and, you know, it's still foreign, right? I mean, you know, battery storage in Texas is a pretty well-known thing, right? Again, it's in the news nowadays. Up here, you don't hear about it much. So I'm still talking to very smart folks that work in energy and have zero exposure to what this is. So, you know, one, I would love to see multiple gigawatts, you know, coming on board in the next, you know, 5 years. Well, dozens, honestly. About two of those, hopefully mine, would be my goal. And then, I would love to see the Rust Belt turning into the Battery Belt. You know, jobs in the U.S. and in all these states. And I think it could be a fantastic thing for the U.S. and be tech forward and tech focused. And it's the right way to move. Let's create value is my mindset.
Very exciting. I'm going to take that. You're going to have to trademark that one.
Yeah, I have like a list of
Rust Belt to the Battery Belt. Go on, let's have the list. All those kind of the bumper stickers.
Actually, let me think. It's Rust Belt to Battery Belt. There's a few that come out, especially when I run through my pitch deck. There's a lot of things I say when I'm doing a pitch that folks are like, oh, that should be in the deck. I'm like, no. I like to deliver it. Really a punchline, you know?
And so the last two questions, the same for everybody. So firstly, is there anything you'd like to plug to our listeners that tend to be energy storage folks in Europe and the US and Australia, tend to be asset owners or bankers or financiers? Anything that you want to tell them right now?
I guess for me, selfishly to start, I'm always interested in projects and capital. So folks that project in the Northeast are looking to flip. I move quick and I get it. So won't waste your time and can be a great buyer. I love to pay more the same as others and have it be a cheaper transaction. And then the other flip side is the capital side. And these are, you know, this is a big capital, you know, pitch and plan that we're getting close on. But the more folks I want to be involved, the better. So happy to talk to folks about it. And I love to educate as well. A really good battery storage 101 that I love to run through. And just after this amount of time, I love taking the complex and making it understandable. So yeah. And then, again, just banging the drum for the Northeast. Battery storage is my, central tenet.
That's your jam. And then, so we always finish with the same question, which is, what is your contrarian view? And I think it's my favorite question. So is there anything, and I've got a feeling you might have a few of these up your sleeve, but is there anything that you believe that not necessarily the rest of the world believes?
So besides come to the Northeast, which I think we've hammered home pretty well, I guess one of the other little mantras is you really want to minimize the hands and the handshake on actual market ops. And again, I love optimizers. I love EMS folks. I love the smarts that they bring to the table. But it's about, again, not to say it's a higher investment item, but the market operator, right? You want the smarts in the same four walls. I really heavily believe in that. So that might be a contrarian view, but to the extent that folks can come together or they come up with great optimization, great algorithms, you name it, but really partner deeply and tightly with the folks that, you know, have the hands on the wheel. You know, the folks that have that, you know, 24/7, 365 desk. Because again, when stuff's in the fan, you really want to make sure that the operators are able to make decisions that can make you that extra 5-10%, you know, year over year.
Paul, want to say a massive thank you for joining us on the podcast. And I tell you what, if you're in Austin or New York, come see us. And if we're in Philadelphia, we'll head down and you can take us around the pubs.
Perfect. Let's do all three.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gio.